Welcome, everybody, to the May 21st, 2012 meeting of the Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, and Economic Development. We have a long list of reports today, and we're going to start off first with on regulatory streamlining. Mr. Granum, geez, he's right there. He's ready to go. You're on.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Senator Beyer, members of the committee. I'm Fred Granum, Special Counsel to the Attorney General for Business. I also serve as the project leader for the Governor's Regulatory Streamlining and Simplification Project, which is why I'm here this afternoon. Thank you for inviting me to appear. We're delighted to give you this update. What I would like to do in this update is remind you of the origins of this project, give you a description of its scope and objectives, describe the approach we've taken to date in this project, give you an update on our progress, and then give you a glimpse over the horizon where some of the issues are that we may be taking this project. Last September, Governor Kitzhaber issued a memorandum in which he recognized that some work needed to be done to adopt the Oregon Business Plan's 2010 regulatory goals and to address the sluggish circumstances of the regulatory arena. And with that, issued a memorandum, and in concert with Attorney General John Kroger and Chief Operating Officer Michael Jordan, chartered a project to be able to come up with a strategic roadmap for long-term change, not quick fixes, but long-term changes for streamlining and simplifying the regulatory processes within our state. The project overview. We've organized with two groups. One is an advisory committee, one is a working group. And the handout that I've provided you, Chairman and members of the committee, include a long list of those working in that advisory group and the working advisory committee and the working group. The advisory committee, as you see, is made up of legislators and different leaders from the public and private sector who've been consulting with the working group, which are agency leaders and senior policy advisors, to be able to come up with this roadmap. We have met extensively over the past months and have taken on the following objectives. The key objective is to propose a long-term strategic roadmap for the governor and for the state of Oregon to take upon itself to be able to simplify and streamline the regulatory processes. We recognize that in years past there's been different initiatives. This is not a new topic, but as we approach this, we recognize that in the past there has not been the long-term commitment, and we're talking a decade long, to be able to take on the changes that need to be done. There are some short-term fixes and medium-term fixes, but it's going to take a long time for these to be able to be adopted and to change the culture that we have currently within the state. Another objective is we want to adopt the Oregon Business Plan regulatory goals. Those were set out in December 2010. Governor-elect Kitzhaber appeared at the Oregon Business Plan and said that he wanted to adopt those. So we are taking the steps to incorporate those within this strategic roadmap. We also are surveying the best practices we will be calling for in this project, the best practices across the state and in some cases other countries where they have taken steps to some innovative approaches to how to make the regulatory processes better, more streamlined. And also one of the core objectives we have here is to achieve better outcomes. In the 21st century, regulations are not going to go away, but as we engage in regulations, we should be able to do more with less, and we should be striving for better outcomes, cleaner water, better worker safety, and the like in the course of processing and organizing under the regulatory arena. And finally, we have been called upon to complement the 10-year plan for Oregon. The governor and the chief operating officer, as you well know, are coming up with a 10-year plan. The roadmap that we'll be outlining, we want to put it in sync with the objectives and approach of that 10-year plan. So our approach, first, is to listen and to study. We know we're not the first folks to talk about this. A lot has been going on years past and ongoing spontaneously in other areas of the government. So we've been actively listening and studying. We want to capture a compelling vision so that as we work in the coming years to achieve the objectives of this roadmap, that we all have a common vision of what we're trying to achieve. In the course of this, our approach is to embrace ongoing projects. These range from projects within agencies, from the one-stop shop for Oregon businesses that this committee and the legislative branch have promoted for the Secretary of State, and a variety of other initiatives. We recognize all go to the same objectives, and we want to embrace and promote those in the course of this strategic roadmap. And with that, we are preparing a detailed roadmap calling for specific actions to be taken by specific dates and calling for continual reporting and transparency to this legislative body, to other branches of government, and to the public at large so that the progress can be monitored, and if the pace slows, people can call for further action to make sure that we do achieve the objectives called for in the roadmap we'll be submitting to the governor. In dealing with our listening and studying, we've studied the past and ongoing efforts to streamline and streamline and simplify regulatory processes, ranging back to Pat Allen's work for Governor Kulongowski, as well as the Oregon Progress Board and other prior initiatives to capture what they've learned and try to adopt the lessons, good and bad, that were present from those experiences. As well, we conducted an agency survey where we contacted all agencies and commissions within the state, had a substantial response, and identified 250 projects under a broadly defined category of what improvement projects are you taking place within your agency, and have then identified in those ongoing projects some that we believe are game changers that we want to promote in the strategic roadmap, and on the other end of the spectrum, some which are so much last century, we question whether they should be going forward. We also posted online what we call the stakeholder survey, where we invited business groups, private sector, and government, local and county governments, to be able to go online and provide a detailed survey to us, where we are our objective being to get some information rather than the generalities of regulations are too long, it takes too hard, or it's too difficult. We posted online a survey that provided us details, names, dates, places, and projects, and the specific issues that were encountered. And from that, we're able to discern some of the key objectives, things that we think should be fixed in the regulatory processes. We've also conducted regional outreach meetings across the state. We have three more to continue, but we've already had meetings in Coos Bay, Astoria, The Dalles, Bend, LeGrand, and Medford. We have meetings now scheduled also in Portland, Burns, and in Eugene in the next couple of weeks. So with that, we've done, I think, a very good effort of reaching out and identifying what are the key issues within the specific regions. The strategic themes that we've identified, and you'll see those as we submit the project report to the governor sometime next month, I expect, that the strategic themes that we are proposing is to nurture a respectful and collaborative culture. And by that, we want to raise the level of discourse. There's too much territorial antics, if you will, by the different agencies, where they're having different standards, different definitions, and different processes between the agencies for the very same topic. We want to also engage the private sector to come up with more innovative ways to deal with the process. We want to build an effective integrated regulatory system. That calls for adoption, more continued adoption of a technology, such as the one-stop shop for business, where we do promote the objectives identified by this committee and the legislative branch to be able to have all permitting and regulatory processes completed online in a coordinated fashion. We're going to be calling for to require clear and non-redundant regulations, which is a no-brainer, but there's a lot of work to be done in that arena to be able to clarify what we mean when with the written word. We want to promote to have seek continuous improvements while striving for better outcomes. The theme that has been played before this committee and this branch before, continuous improvement, quality performance metrics, a whole quality management system needs to be introduced into these state agencies. The key objective we're looking for here is to achieve timely, predictable, value-based outcomes. And as Senator Beyer, as you in some of the meetings we've had, you've been one of the strongest advocates that what we're looking here is for timely and predictable, consistent outcomes so that it doesn't depend on which agency individual within an agency is called upon to do a process. You get the same result. And to do so in a fashion that is predictable, in a time that can be forecasted accurately in advance so that we can have consistent results and better outcomes for our constituents. So the next steps, as we're completing the outreach, as I mentioned, we have a couple of more meetings to conduct. We're going to be adopting a vision statement at our meeting later this month. We're preparing the strategic roadmap. It's in a draft form now. We continue to be working on that to a final form. We'll be submitting that and promoting that to the governor next month. And then following that, we'll be looking for enlisting long-term support. One of the key objectives here is so that this fine, fancy report that we might be submitting doesn't simply get put into a three-ring binder and placed on a shelf, that for it to be able to have lasting results, it's going to have champions within the agencies, promoters and supporters within the legislative branch, and disciplined long-term leadership from the executives of the state. So with that, I welcome any questions you may have.
So what have you heard from stakeholders so far? I know you've had the surveys and all that. What have you been hearing?
We've been hearing concerns about the inconsistency of between different agencies. We, as you well know, different agencies, I'll take, for example, dealing with water issues. That any number of agencies deal with water issues, and if someone is going to have any issues with water, they deal with a variety of agencies. They have different standards for and different definitions for the same topic and different timelines, and sometimes or oftentimes called for replicating information from agency A to agency B, and that seems to be with different outcomes and different specifications just doesn't seem to be coherent. So with that, they're looking for coordination in those ranks. One of the other objectives is the ability to have the ability at the outset of a project to have feedback from the agency as to when it will be, when there will be a response. If Nordstrom are running this state, they'd be able to tell you that they'll have this project, you know, a response back in 48 days. Right now, so often is the case, it's we'll notify you as soon as we can. Now, there's some statutory deadlines, and those are generally adhered and promoted, but as a default, those now become the duration. In many cases, if there's a 120-day deadline, it gets done on 120 days when it could be done earlier. Now, having said all of that, there is work to be done from the private sector as well, and that is for the private sector to engage on a higher level so that the applications that are submitted coherently. If one of the concerns and issues we do identify is that someone applies for a particular permit but doesn't give all the information necessary, and then you find yourself in that spiral of the agency asking for more information and the applicant thinking that they've already done it and feeling like they're being backsided by the agencies. So it's a matter of coming up with processes that assure and inform the applicant when their application is complete and having timelines start from there.
I'm kind of struck with it. I remember, it was a long time ago, where I think it was during a prior Kitzhaber administration where a bunch of his team went to the Netherlands and was on the environmental standards and came back and were impressed that the governmental entity there was able to set and say, okay, this is our goal. Industry, you go out and you come up with the way how you're going to meet this goal. And we never got anywhere close to that kind of a system.
But that's one example where we do want to engage in this strategic roadmap, the ability to come up with new approaches, incentives for avoiding the contamination, for incentives and rewards for those that are able to do to meet the to exceed the standards. I think that's critical to take this out of government identifying exactly what the answer is and put more and more of it into the private enterprise to come up looking at the outcome and not the process.
Are you expecting any requests for legislation in 13?
I anticipate there will be some. I'm not confident exactly what those may be, but I don't know of any of them that would be particularly controversial out on the short term. We are going to be calling for some additional studies on some of the issues which may require legislation. But the cornerstone of the first out-of-the-box issue that we want to do is we've identified some case studies, some pilot projects. Some are underway, some they're going to be teed up, that we want to monitor and learn from the processes. And as you well know, Chairman Beyer, the the work that Dick Peterson and DEQ is doing with the dredge field project, where they have that Kaizen method approach to working with five state agencies and four federal agencies to streamline the dredge field 401, 404 processes. That is a cornerstone of the types of approach that need to be adopted here throughout the agencies in the regulatory arena.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you for being here to present. I would hope that there's going to be some legislative proposals. I mean, we've been talking about this for a number of years, and I know that this more formalized process that you're engaging in right now has not been going for years, but the interest in regulatory streamlining has been, and I will be a little bit disappointed if we don't have something that's short of non-controversial to take on in this next legislative session, because as I think about the regulatory landscape, whether it's environmental permitting or land use or energy siting or whatever, I mean, all of those are really controversial issues in the state of Oregon, and I don't know how you get to the meat of this issue without taking on something that's somewhat controversial. I understand that there's value in pilot projects and case studies, so you can see, okay, before we roll this out statewide, how did it work when we did it here or did it there? But I would at least hope that some of those pilot projects push the edge of the envelope, because otherwise we'll, you know, nibble around the edges. And we'll have pilot projects that are kind of, milk toast, and then have nothing that makes really substantial change to streamlining the regulatory process in the state. So that's just my 2 cents worth. So
thank you, Senator.
Anybody else? Well, Fred, I really appreciate your enthusiasm, and I know it's sincere on your part. I remain a bit of a skeptic on it. I do notice that on the working group, which I think is the group that's been meeting most, Jeremy Rogers is the only involved person from the private side. That concerns me, but we'll give you the benefit of the doubt, and I think I'll ask you back for an update when we meet again in September.
I welcome the opportunity, Senator.
I think it's really important that we build that relationship of collaboration and get down to the vital fuel and more certainty on issues, and I know that's a big issue. So thank you very much for coming today and doing that. If that's it, we'll close out on this one, and thank you, Fred.
Thank you very much.
We will move to Dr. Druckers. Drucker. Welcome, and thank you very much for coming down.
Thank you, Chairman Beyer, member of the committee. I'm Dr. Brian Drucker, the director of the OHSU Knight Cancer Institute. I'm grateful to be here to testify in front of this committee with really nothing to ask other than really just tell you about what we're doing and to also share with you some of the what we believe will be some of the economic impact of what we're doing. By way of background, in July, I will celebrate 19 years in Oregon. About this time 19 years ago, I was working at Harvard's Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And at that time in my career, I had a dream. And that dream was that we could target cancer cells specifically without harming normal cells. As we turn the clock back 20 years ago, the view in the world generally was that that would never work. And it was certainly the view at Harvard that this would never work. And I was invited to pursue positions elsewhere in the country. I found my way to a place that had a little bit more of an entrepreneurial pioneering spirit in Oregon, where Grover Bagby, who was the founding director of the OHSU Cancer Institute, recruited me, offered me laboratory space and a position. And within 6 weeks of arriving here, I had established a collaboration with a drug company that had a patented compound that I brought into my lab that specifically killed leukemia cells without harming normal cells. Now, it took me 5 years to convince this drug company to move to clinical trials because they never thought they'd see a return on their investment. But I was not only a researcher, but I was also a physician seeing patients who desperately needed this life-saving medication. And in June of 1998, 14 years ago, the first patient in the world received the medication we now know as Gleevec. And within 6 months, 100% of our patients were responding. And 3 years later, we received FDA approval for this drug, the fastest FDA approval in the history of the FDA. This medication for a leukemia called chronic myeloid leukemia turned a disease with a 3 to 5 year life expectancy into one that we assume will now allow people to live a normal lifespan with a single once-a-day pill with minimal side effects. Now, what's happened since then is that when you hear words like personalized cancer therapy or personalized medicine or targeted therapy, all that started right here in our great state of Oregon, and I'm extremely proud of the fact that this happened here in Oregon. But it has completely changed the way that we think about treating cancer. We now understand that we can target cancer specifically. We can develop treatments that will kill cancer without harming normal cells. And there have been now dozens of FDA-approved medications that follow this lead and hundreds more in clinical trials. Now, over the past 4 or 5 years, as I've looked at the possibilities and opportunities for what do I do next in my career and have explored many options outside of the state of Oregon, I decided that I wanted to do something here in Oregon to give back to this great state. So I've decided to stay. I became the director of the OHSU Cancer Institute and began to reach out to community partners for what we might be able to do. About 3 years ago, we received a $100 million gift from Phil and Penny Knight, and we renamed ourselves the OHSU Knight Cancer Institute. And with that, we have decided to embark upon a strategic plan to make sure that we're investing purposefully. We recognize that we have a leadership role in this field of personalized cancer therapies or targeted cancer therapies, or we target the cancer specifically without harming normal cells. In order to accomplish that for every patient with cancer and every type of cancer, we know that we have to invest in more researchers, more discovery, more understanding of what drives the growth of every cancer. Along those lines, we have begun to recruit several research stars to Oregon. We have recruited several recently, one by the name of Dr. Joe Gray, one of the world's foremost breast cancer researchers, from Northern California, also Dr. Lisa Cousins, also from UC San Francisco. Each of them have brought research teams of 20 to 30 people here with them. These are all college graduates, many with masters and many with PhDs working in their laboratories. So a highly skilled workforce that we brought here to work on the cancer problem. And over the next 5 to 10 years, we'll estimate we'll bring about 50 researchers here for a total of about 250 new people working here in Oregon on the cancer problem. We also recognize that we have to invest in diagnosing cancer and understanding it, so we set up the Knight Diagnostic Laboratories. What we're doing in our laboratories is we're taking tumor samples and analyzing them for the molecular drivers, the abnormalities that drive the growth of their cancer. In our laboratory, we have the ability to test for 650 mutations across 50 different genes, and many of them we can link to clinical trials that we have ongoing. I can tell you that there's no other cancer center in the country that has that capability. In fact, other centers are sending samples to us because of our unique capabilities. We see that this has some commercial potential, that we can obtain samples throughout the region, throughout the nation, that will allow us to see some revenue that we can turn back into our research and discovery engine. The third area where we're investing is in many collaborative approaches. So if you look at some of the things that we have to do, for example, our life sciences building, which is down on the waterfront, will open in about a year to year and a half. We have set up collaborative relationships with FEI, a high-end microscopy company in Hillsboro. They are setting up a living laboratory with us, with Dr. Joe Gray, so they can understand how their instrument will be used to understand or image cells as they move around the body. What they want to create are the next generation of instruments that can be used in health sciences, so their business benefits by the relationship with our scientists, and our scientists get to bring new technologies as well for their research. We have another relationship we've established with Oracle to begin to take all this data that we're generating, huge amounts of data as we decode the entire human genome in every single cancer and apply that to individual patients to get them the maximum benefit. Again, we have many other collaborations that we're establishing to try to bring the best to patients here in Oregon. But I also want to make the point that this is not just about OHSU. We care deeply about administering care throughout the state. We have a long-standing relationship with Salem Cancer Institute and a formal affiliation that we've had for over a decade. We have recently announced a letter of intent with Legacy Health Systems to collaborate on the delivery of cancer care throughout the Portland metro region. We have recently, within the past 2 years, established a formal relationship with the Columbia Memorial Hospital in Astoria, where we send an OHSU oncologist to their hospital 2 days a week so that patients who need care in the community can stay in their community. We also have a long-standing relationship with Coos Bay for radiation therapy. We're providing some of the radiation therapy in that community. Our point is we're trying to provide, elevate the level of care throughout the state and throughout the region by partnering with these individual healthcare providers. We're also grateful for significant support from more than just Phil and Penny Knight. We've received $5 million from John Gray, a well-known developer in the state of Oregon for melanoma research. We've received $2.5 million from the Boyle family, Columbia Sportswear, $2.5 million from Gerald Wen. I actually am the holder of the Gerald Wen Chair of Leukemia Research. And annually we receive between $500,000 to $800,000 from Safeway Foundation because they want to support local entities within the community they serve. So we are very proud of what we have in Oregon. We're very proud of what we're building. And our view is that no patient in Oregon should have to leave because of lack of expertise, that we can provide that care either at OHSU or in their community, with a long-term goal being to improve the quality of care for patients suffering from cancer here in our state. And I'm very grateful to be living and working here. At this point, I'd like to turn this over to Steve Statham.
Hi, thank you very much. My name is Steve Statham. I'm the Chief Operating Officer of the Knight Cancer Institute, and it's a pleasure to be here. I just want to briefly underscore a couple points. First of all, our mission, although it's to end cancer as we know it, we believe if we do it well, we will indeed see some economic development benefits. And so, for example, over this decade, we're projecting investing between $200 and $300 million in the Cancer Institute and its growth, the recruitment of scientists, and the other programs that we have. That's going to be coming from philanthropy, some of which Dr. Drucker mentioned, hopefully additional philanthropy, but also from commercialization activities, including the diagnostic labs that he mentioned. We've launched our strategic plan about 2 years ago, and since then we've added 50 new jobs, and we've added to our grant awards, our research awards, an additional $4.5 million on top of what was already coming in. And that's money that's coming in from outside the state in terms of grant award agencies in the federal government or foundations that are providing research awards for cancer research. And so we anticipate that increasing over the next several years while we grow the Cancer Institute. We're also hiring business development and technology transfer staff so that we can develop additional partnerships when scientists like Dr. Drucker have good ideas that can be commercialized. We want to do that and add to the partnerships, in addition to partnerships with large organizations like Oracle and FEI that he mentioned, spin-offs or small companies that can generate commercialization and hopefully jobs for the region and also advance getting these ideas into practice in clinics and in additional research. So we're not an economic development enterprise, but when we do our mission well, we think that there's a substantial economic development benefit. So thank you very much for letting us testify.
Comments, questions? Senator Edwards? Real briefly, and thank you both for being here. You mentioned, I think I heard partnerships with in Salem, Astoria, Coos Bay. Did I miss any there?
Those are the only ones I mentioned, but there are
okay.
Others.
Yes. No,
and Legacy as well in the Portland metro area.
Right, okay, and Legacy. The point that I just wanted to
I don't know, I guess bring to everybody's attention is that there have been a lot of discussions about governance in our university system. And OHSU has been pointed to often in that discussion. And I think it's been my experience that OHSU has done a pretty good job at serving the public, serving a public mission. And I just wanted to bring that, you know, we're not here to talk about that, but it's something that flashed in my mind as you're talking about how you are working throughout the state to bring benefits to Oregonians. So I appreciate that. Thank you,
Senator Edwards.
Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. A handful of comments, questions, but first of all, I want to say thank you to Susie and to your department who just did a miraculous recovery of one of your patients from Southern Oregon that was taken care of very nicely last week. So thank you. Since you're here, I'll embarrass you.
Thank you.
I don't know if you gentlemen recall, but in my other life, I've been involved in companies and cancer. And we had a meeting about a year and a half ago on a company called Zetarex that has to do with T-cell therapy.
Yes.
And the company's done fantastic as far as the intellectual property and the getting to trials on that therapy. The question, the problem we had, and I guess the, just since we're here, talking about $202 to $300 million invested, lab space, and commercialization, it's been my experience that that's really hard to do in Oregon, not only come up with the lab space and come up with the strategic partnerships to attract other cancer research. Is that changing, or is it just going to be difficult?
Well, Senator Atkins, thank you for your question. For me, the most difficult part was going on a recruitment, recruiting somebody like Joe Gray, who's a nationally recognized figure in cancer research, was hard work. It took almost 2 years to get him here and a lot of arm twisting. But once Joe got here, that made Lisa Cousins, another nationally recognized breast cancer expert. And just to give you an idea of how good she is, she's bringing with her a promise grant from the Komen Foundation for the Cure of $6.5 million. There were two of them awarded in the entire nation, and she was one of them. That's how good she is. She came because I was here and because Joe Gray was here. With Joe Gray and Lisa Cousins here, the caliber of people that are knocking on our door and saying, what's going on in Oregon, has become much greater. The caliber of recruit that we're seeing coming through now is fabulous, and the level of excellence we're tracking is absolutely amazing. So we've reached a critical point of momentum where we have momentum behind us in our recruitments. Yes, we are going to run out of space. We're working on that vigorously. We have the land space down on the Schnitzer campus to put up new buildings. So I'm confident that over time we will have enough room to house the people that we're recruiting. But you're right, it is a lot of hard work, and it's been very hard trying to get the wind at our back, but I feel the wind is at our back now.
Could you further explain where the money, the 200 to 300, is going to be invested?
Sure. Senator Atkinson, primarily that will be invested in recruiting these top scientists and their teams. They're sort of like recruiting companies to come out of state and take up, open their doors at OHSU. It can cost $10 or $20 million to bring a scientific team here. There's usually a lot of equipment. There's a startup period before they're all able to get funded on grants. While their work continues, grants don't always transfer. There's usually new talent that they want to recruit or new scientific program they want to build. So a lot of this will be in people that we'll be bringing into Oregon, some of whom will be here already, but many of whom will be coming with new expertise. And then we will be also investing in space, additional lab space. So the life sciences building down at the Schnitzer campus at the South Waterfront, Joe Gray will occupy that along with PSU collaborators, but he'll pay for that space as an occupant to the collaboration between OHSU, OSU, and PSU. So the rent, it's expensive space, it's vibration-free space for the kind of imaging work he does and that sort of thing. So people and space and equipment are the main investments. And we hope that out of that we'll generate some ideas that can be spun out into new companies. And I think what your question may have been alluding to is we still have challenges in Oregon with accelerator space for private labs and for relocating private companies. We hope that that climate will improve, certainly as the quality of the science and the ideas gets better and better, as Dr. Drucker mentioned. The other challenge is getting the capital, you know, into this region. But I think it's getting better, but it's small steps.
One more question, and then I'll follow them outside when they're done and talk to them in the hall. But, let's talk about capital real quick. So you have this beautiful, wonderful endowment, this fantastic, world-class space that you're in, and yet we can't, and the policymakers here, we have thousands of task forces and hours and commissions, and we can't drum up $1 for biotech investment. And I'm trying to think of the name of the organization, Markham Capital.
Right, Markham
Hill Capital.
Markham Hill Capital, mm-hmm. That failed. What? Give me, in a perfect world, what would you have to be able to do your work from the state of Oregon? So Markham Hill Capital was three top minds out of Oregon Health Sciences went to put this together. They were guaranteed, I think, a little $5 million start from the state. And they were going to match it with another $5 million. The thing crumbled in 18 months. The state never came through. The whole thing crumbled, wasted a whole bunch of time. Yeah. That's the gist.
I think I'll take a stab in that. Dr. Drucker can correct me or add to it. I think the state, number one, needs to make a decision and stick to it if it's interested in biotech. It takes a long time. There's usually two or three things that are needed. One is space for these companies. So these companies start, and they're not generating much in the way of revenue. They may have a little bit of revenue, but the space is very expensive. Picture the top-end office space in Portland and double it. They can't afford that rent, so there's a rent subsidy. When we talk about accelerators, it's really to manage the space costs and pool resources to make it efficient, but it's really rent for high-end lab space and usually equipment that can be shared, but that's still costly. And then there's the talent. Someone like Dr. Drucker is not going to have the time to run a company, even if he has a good idea. So there needs to be somebody paired with him who can work with his ideas, who's gone through the FDA process or whatever regulatory process and has gone into commercialization. There aren't that many people in Oregon, although there are some who've done it, and we need to attract and retain them to stay there. So I would say a long-term commitment, support for an accelerator, which is mainly about space and equipment. Yes, it can be shared, but the private sector, it's a classic case, in my opinion at least, where there is a role for the state because the private sector, to get these companies through what we sometimes call the valley of death, from the idea to proof of concept and commercialization, they just can't make it without that. And then talent, attracting talent and retaining talent.
Thank you very much.
There was an accelerator, used to call them incubators, business incubators, that was created up there, wasn't biotech, in the Portland area. Small one with,
PSU has an accelerator that OHSU partners with. It's relatively small, and it's located, I can't really describe it for you, but it's where the Rwindy Road, just north of Ross Island Bridge, mm-hmm. and the downtown side. And there is a small, it's in a building that they have converted for that, and I think there are three or four or five companies that are working in there. What you want is you want to incubate so that there's a company formed, and then you want to get them to that point where they get venture capital and can fly on their own, and that's what we need. That's that accelerator. And that's what Markham Hill Capital was going to do, and it got close to raising its critical mass of funding, but as Senator Atkinson noted, it didn't quite make it. Of course, the timing with the global economy wasn't optimal. It was a good idea, though.
The same discussion is going on in the south end of the valley.
Uh-huh.
With Oregon sure. State and the University yeah. of Oregon, some of the same kinds
similar ideas
of things.
And similar challenges.
Exactly. And it's hood space is very expensive. Mm-hmm. Expensive.
Yes, but our goal is to bring in the intellectual horsepower. The researchers are going to have the ideas. What we want to create around them is the ability to spin out their ideas easily.
Right.
In my case, I have a company in Portland with 60 employees. I couldn't have done that, as Steve said. Somebody came in, invested in a company around an idea that I had, and it now has a of revenue about $10 million a year with 60 employees. We can do it. It's just a matter of getting the right people hooked to the right investors and with enough patience to see this through.
Senator. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welfare, an agency that's not an economic development agency, there are many economic development agencies that would be very proud of your record. So I hear what you're saying, but I think you are being overly modest. My question was along the same lines as Senator Atkinson. You know, we're seeing all this philanthropy, all the funding and all the focus, as it should be for the basic research is what you're talking about. And I'm just wondering if you've thought of other formats to really smooth the transition from the basic research into a marketed product.
We spent a lot of time thinking about that. And our primary goal is to get our discoveries into people. That's mm-hmm. what we really want to do. But if there are opportunities for spin-outs of our ideas, we actually just hired a gentleman by the name of Joseph Carroll, who's our Associate Director for Business Development, mm-hmm. whose sole purpose is to look at commercialization potential of our ideas, of our biomarkers, of any other intellectual property, and get that out into the commercial sector to accelerate its development. So we're absolutely committed to that, Senator Burdick.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, I think it might be a good idea for this committee to have a conversation with him about what his plans are, because
yes. mm-hmm.
this is going to be a huge, you know, if we could set up a, mm-hmm. you know, the silicon biomedic, whatever it is up there, that would be a huge economic boon.
Yes.
So what I was missing and not waiting for, not hearing, was some form of an ask. I do think this is, you're bringing up a very good subject, important subject. I think as we look at economic development, which is a charge of this committee, one of the areas, I mean, the old industry, hear a lot of discussion about the old manufacturing industry has gone away someplace else. This is the new stuff that's coming along. We talked a lot about our education goals of 40-40-20. We got to be training our young people for a job that's going to exist, and we're going to have to create those, and I think a lot of it is brand new stuff that's coming out. It's not the only thing we do in this area, but I think you're absolutely right. I commend you on what you've done. I mean, being able to, in essence, create your own industry coming along is, and frankly, the human side of it is just wonderful what you've done.
Thank you, sir.
Really appreciate it. More folks? Thank you very much. I got a sense that I'm going to lose one of my members here.
Cancer versus brownfields. Cancer.
All righty.
Keith?
Next up, we're going to talk about industrial lands.
That's my old friend Keith Levitt.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Keith Levitt, General Manager of Business Development and Properties at the Port of Portland. The Port is a partner on the Regional Industrial Land Study along with Business Oregon, Metro, Portland Business Alliance, and NAOP, which is our Commercial Real Estate Industry Trade Association. With me is Bernie Bottomley from Portland Business Alliance. And Bernie and I will tag team the slides. We'll try to move through the slides fairly efficiently so that we have some time left over for questions. Also with us is Kirk Olson from Dermody Partnership, which is a developer, and Kirk also is representing NAOP in this on this study team. The background of the study that we've done is to really look at the industrial land supply within the metropolitan region inside the urban growth boundary, and to look at it from the standpoint of what land do we have that's ready for the market, not so much look at it from a 20-year kind of gross acreage planning horizon, but much more what is available now in the market, and particularly focused on large parcels, 25 acres and above, because those are the kinds of parcels of land that we know that traded sector economic development strategies really require. And we also wanted to be able to illuminate the industrial land discussion in a way that informs a lot of discussions happening in the region and within the state on economic development and on the industrial land supply. The purpose of the project, this is really to have a market tool. We want to be able to update this inventory. It's really a snapshot in time. Some land, probably we started the study about a year ago, and I'm sure some of the land that is in the inventory has now been absorbed by the market. And so we want to keep this updated on a regular basis. Again, we want to focus the discussion so that Metro, the Port, State of Oregon, and others that are very engaged in this whole issue of industrial land and economic development have a good basis base of information. Next. The phase one process for the study, we started with a pretty wide net. We looked at hundreds of sites using Metro's buildable land inventory. We then put those sites through a screen of, you had to be 25 acres, it had to be zoned industrial, it had to be or comp planned industrial within the urban growth boundary. We then looked at site analysis and constraints and came out with a net developable acreage. And if you were not at least 25 net developable acreage after that part of the analysis, you weren't in the inventory. The other part that we subtracted out were user-owned expansion sites. Intel, Solar World, other players in the region have land that is really banked for future expansion and not available on the market. And so we understand where that land is, but we did not use that for purposes of the analysis. And then finally, we took the land that is in the inventory and we put it in tiers. How quickly can that land come to market? And that's looking at permit requirements, wetland issues, infrastructure, transportation, and making some value judgments about how long it would take to bring those sites to a market-ready status. So the tiering is similar to perhaps what you've seen before from the state of Oregon. This is consistent with the site certification program. Tier one is essentially considered market ready. If you had an industrial development opportunity and you could turn dirt within 6 months, then you're in tier one. And this is more typical of the kind of recruitments, the time frames that a typical recruitment would be looking for. Tier two is 7 months to 2.5 years, and as you get further out into that time frame, of course, you're probably not in the running for the kind of recruitments that the state or the region is looking for, and you're probably going to need a pretty patient developer that's able to acquire the site and get the site developed to a point where it's ready for market investment. Tier three, even further out, and what you'll see with the inventory is that we have most of our sites in tier three, and that's 2.5 years and beyond, and so that's in a lot of ways that's the conundrum that we're facing. So findings from phase one, we had when we went through the analysis, we started with a couple hundred different sites that we initially looked at. And then we put it through the analysis, and so 56 sites are in the inventory. These are, again, sites that are net developable acreage above 25 acres. Nine are in Tier 1, 16 sites are in Tier 2, and then 31 are in Tier 3. When you dig a little deeper into the Tier 1 sites, five of those sites have broad market appeal. Two of the sites are lease only. The Port of Portland happens to own those sites, and we know that you're really speaking to a little more of a discrete segment of the industrial market when you're only willing to lease versus sell property. One of the sites is not efficiently shaped for the typical industrial development, and then one is well above the market. So five sites in the metropolitan region with broad market appeal that are in that Tier 1 category. And this slide here is really the punchline. You can see that the predominant grouping of sites is the 25 to 50 acres, which is where most of the market activity would go. But there's only seven of those sites in Tier 1, and you see 21 sites in Tier 3. More challenging for us into the future is we only have one 50-acre site in the entire region. That's the Nike site out off Highway 26. It's a little over 50 acres. We only have one 100-acre site in the region. The port owns that site. Now we own that site. It's out in Gresham that was formerly the LSI property, and we recently made that acquisition. And we've got zero in Tier 2 for the 100-acre category. And the reason that that's important, you may not every year take down a 100-acre site, but every few years you're probably going to have someone interested. And these are the kinds of projects like an Intel or a Solar World or a Genentech or even a FedEx ground that came out to Troutdale that are needing those types of acreages, and that's where you get the big job generation. Bernie will talk a little bit more about what we did in the phase two of the study, but we looked a lot more closely at the Tier 2 and Tier 3 development constraints. And, you know, one of the issues that we face within the metropolitan region, and certainly we've seen that with the port's historic land ownership, we've really plucked the low-hanging fruit, and we're now out of our historic land supply, and we're the hill to climb to find the next generation of large industrial sites in the region is just a higher, steeper hill to climb. And those issues are really brownfield issues. We have several sites in the inventory that are brownfields. We have three sites in the inventory that are in the Lower Willamette Harbor, which is a Superfund area. It's a wet region, as we all know, and so wetland-related development impacts is a big issue, getting those permits, and you can see on down the line there. We'll talk briefly here about the demand side. This was a supply-side study, and I think it certainly shows a challenging snapshot for a lack of these larger sites that are available. From a demand side, we didn't focus there on the study, but we did survey kind of recent data. And what we found is that there is consistent interest in 50 and even 100-acre sites in any given year. I know at the Port of Portland, over the last 7 or 8 years, we've done about seven different transactions above 25 acres. And when we look at the sources of information out there, Business Oregon, in looking over the last year, about 76 leads that came into the state that had acreage requirements, 25% of those needed acreage above 25 acres. And talking with the private sector, the brokers, there was a study done by Johnson & Reed. It looked over the last decade and interviewed six brokers in the metro region, and they said on average about 11 leads a year for sites that are greater than 50 acres. So we're very concerned that we're missing out on opportunity for lack of land and lack of choice, lack of market choice. What are the different traded sector categories require? This is information, again, from Business Oregon. So when you're looking at regional or nationally scaled clean tech, 50 acres, up to 100 acres, like a Solar World in the globally scaled clean tech. The manufacturing categories between 10 and 25 acres, high-tech campus at least 25 acres, and then warehousing, distribution, and logistics would range all the way from 25 to 80 acres. You can see FedEx ground is the what's shown there in the picture. They needed 78 acres. The port had acquired a former Superfund site in Troutdale and had committed to a phase one development to essentially move that site out of a Tier 3 status into a Tier 2 in order to get that deal done. And that's 850 jobs that are now in Troutdale. And I think if they were looking at this market today, they would not find that 78-acre site that has the kind of highway access that they have here in Troutdale. So with that, I'll ask Bernie to summarize the Phase 2 findings.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Bernie Bottomley with the Portland Business Alliance. So after we completed the inventory of the industrial sites in the region, we wanted to take a look at the pipeline and figure out what the challenges are and the cost to move the Tier 2 and Tier 3 sites into a state of being ready for current development. So we selected 11 sites in the two latter tiers to be representative of the kinds of challenges that we face in the region. They weren't necessarily the low-hanging fruit, but they represented a variety of issues: land use, wetlands, site aggregation, and the like. We then did a site plan for each site, pretty detailed. We looked at what kind of development should go on that kind of site, what size, how many employees, what kind of payroll they would have to generate the economic benefit of the successful recruitment of a business there. We use independent market analytics to develop our site analysis, and we also engage the state wetland and brownfield consultation process when the site had those kinds of issues associated with it. So these are the 11 sites around the region, pretty broadly geographically dispersed, but mostly on the edges of the region, because as you would expect, the core areas don't have large lot supply anymore. It's going to be around the margins mostly. So the issues that we identified in terms of costs, these are the median costs for bringing a site to readiness. As you can see, floodplain issues are the major one. Transportation is also a significant issue. Site surcharge, which is cut and fill. As Keith mentioned, most of the sites, or all the sites that we looked at, had, excuse me, were relatively level, but even on a level site, you're going to have some cut and fill issues that have to be done before the site's ready for development. So after we looked at the costs of getting the site ready, we looked at the benefit in terms of tax revenue that's generated by successful recruitment or expansion. And this is a site out in Washington County that would be amenable to a high-tech industrial application like an Intel, like a Solar World. And the bar to the left, the column to the left in the light gray, is the development period. So we looked at the wages and taxes that would be paid by the construction period. And then in the right-hand box, that's a darker gray, once the facility is up and running, you can see that the tax revenues are very distinct in the pattern that they follow. This analysis assumes some property tax benefits to the company to recruit them here, so that's why you don't see the property tax kicking in at year one. But clearly, the big winner, if this site were to develop as we analyzed it, is the state and the payroll tax. So, as Keith mentioned, there's very few large, particularly very large lots, either in Tier 1 or in the pipeline, particularly for those 50 and 100-acre sites, very limited. The larger the site is, typically the bigger the challenge it faces. A lot of the sites face multiple challenges, from site aggregation to wetlands to annexation to transportation infrastructure. A lot of those, we kind of know what the timeline is on them, but site aggregation is really a wild card. The more chopped up the property ownership is, the more multiple owners you have, the more difficulty you have in predicting when that site's going to be become available. And the longer the time frame between where the site is now and where when it can be developed, the greater the risk for the developer is. So the higher the risk level, the less likely it is that the private sector is going to be able to come in there on its own and purchase that property, put the investment into, particularly into site aggregation, invest in the capital infrastructure in the hopes that the development will actually occur. And as I mentioned, the beneficiary, once it does turn and we do get the development, is the state through the payroll tax. So the next steps, we'll be putting the final report together in July, and this says September for the Oregon business plan, but I think we're going to try to accelerate that so that we can have some ideas for this committee and the House committee sooner than the end of September, so that we can give you our thoughts about some ways to try to address this dynamic. With that, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
I'm curious, Bernie, the category you had there for floodplain was obviously the most expensive. What's the remediation that you're looking at there?
Hi, Kirk Olson here representing NAOP. The floodplain costs are really associated with filling the site to accommodate a building that is now out of the floodplain. 100-year floodplain elevation. When you fill a pad to prepare it for a building, you need to dig a deeper spot to so it balances, so aggregate stays the same.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you, gentlemen.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Next up, we're shifting to transportation. Ms. Peterson.
You sit there.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair, Senators. My name is Lynn Peterson. I'm the Sustainable Communities and Transportation Advisor to the Governor. We just wanted to give you a quick update today on what we called the Non-Roadway Transportation Funding Task Force. This concept comes out of conversations from over a year and a half ago from stakeholders who were involved in all of the work, including a lot of you, that led up to the Jobs and Transportation Act, who said, you know, we did a really great job getting everybody to the table and talking about what the needs are for transportation in the transportation system between governance and funding and making the system work more efficiently. But what we didn't get around to in the actual Jobs and Transportation Act was the discussion around funding for the non-roadway transportation and issues related to that. And of course, between the time the Jobs and Transportation Act passed and where we are today, there's been several big obstacles put in the way of non-roadway transportation funding. And when I say non-roadway, I mean what we're talking about is rail, air, marine, transit, bike, and ped. It's basically everything but the roads. So as you'll recall, in the last legislative session, BETSI credits were redefined, and transit agencies across the state were no longer able to use those energy tax credits into the future, which means that we're going to see about a 20% cut in reduction in service levels for most of the rural transit districts. And also what happened was the bonding capacity of the lottery-backed bonding went down, and so Connect Oregon went down from its normal 100 per biennium to about 40. So the need and the hue and cry became louder. And at the exact same time, an organization with a Rockefeller grant came forward, Smart Growth America, and said, we'd like to have a conversation with you about non-roadway transportation funding. We'd like to work with three states. And we said, we're ready. We have a growing need, just like everyone else, and so we'd like to have this conversation. So at that point, when we got the Rockefeller grant, we brought on Oregon Consensus, which is Michael Mills sitting to my left, and we started up a conversation. Michael, do you want to talk a little bit about how we went about having a conversation with a small group of 46 stakeholders?
Yeah, it was quite an unusually large group. First, I want to thank you,
yes,
Chair Beyer and committee members for having us here.
And
I mentioned that Senator Beyer, the chair here, is the co-chair of the working group, so he knows this information intimately, as well as his partner in the co-chair role of Mayor Phil Hauck from Pendleton. But this was a relatively fast track for the number of people that were involved. and for the number of issues that we were dealing with. Had three meetings. First, November 7th, it was a wide-open brainstorming meeting that we held here. All the meetings were here in Salem. Everything was on the table. It was thoroughly hashed through. The technical experts then took that information back, started compiling that while we still allowed more information to be submitted during the interim. On the January 30th meeting, the technical experts created a criterion funding evaluation framework to start sorting out these recommendations. As I mentioned, they're very broad and across the board. Some were popular, some weren't. They were able to go through the matrix of the more than 60 funding options. The last meeting that was held on April 5th was reviewing the results, trying to do a gut check of which ones were reasonable, which ones weren't, what the pros and cons were, whether things were left off the list or should be resorted on the matrix. So that process has taken place. There was a poll that was done over a period of one of the meetings with all the stakeholders, and as you might imagine, the easy funding mechanisms that produced the lowest amount of revenue, everyone agreed to. The difficult ones, the large volumes of revenue, were fairly divided, showing we had a very diverse committee that we were working with. So the final next steps, the work group is, they're due to have their comments back by the close of business today. The technical team will finalize the report, and it's scheduled to be submitted to the governor on the 29th next week. And one key thing to remember, that as opposed to recommendations that are being moved forward as some sort of legislative package, because of the breadth and depth of the issues and the funding mechanisms, this is really a point where the discussion with the broader community can take place on these recommendations.
So just to pick up from there, that's kind of the process we went through. It's three quick meetings in a very short period of time, just to kind of bring everybody and frame what the issues were. And the second piece of paper that you have, which is a quick reference summary, we just put together quickly so that you could see what kind of things are going to be in the report. But there's two parts to this. One was a need, an update on the work done for JTA on the governor's visioning report. And ODOT, Victor Dodier, put together a wonderful estimate going back to the Oregon Transportation Plan that the governor's visioning document was based on, and updating the numbers. And you'll see that the need for non-roadway transportation funding is estimated, and let me asterisk that estimated at somewhere around $500 million. Now, every single one of the stakeholders involved said that their portion of that $500 million annual was estimated as too low. But the reason that this is difficult to get your hands around and being able to articulate the need is because we don't have a centralized database for the state for all transit district operation and capital projects. We don't have a centralized database for all ports and their activities. Each organization has some idea of what their top priority projects are, but we don't have a pipeline of projects. So that was probably the first piece of information that I just wanted to share with you today. The second one is on the backside was the top 14, 15 that kind of rose to the top based on the ranking that Michael talked about. And those ranking criteria were funding potential, ease of implementation, economic effects, and political feasibility. Two things that you will not see at the top of this list that fall to the bottom, for example. One was a sales tax. Transit folks always want to have that conversation about a sales tax. It obviously did not rise to the top because of political feasibility. That doesn't mean it's a bad idea. It's just not the conversation folks want to have right now. As Michael said, the transit operations is a big nut to crack right now. The other one was that the governor had specifically asked this group not to look at breaking the trust fund in terms of the gas tax. They did want to have that conversation. They did have that conversation, but it did not rise to the top. So that's the kind of things that you don't see on here. That does not mean that the things on this list are easy or fully vetted or fully thought out. They were concepts that rose to the top, such as concepts out of Eastern Oregon cities that you might have heard in the last session about sequestering income tax. So if you were to have an employment area and the income grows, the income tax grows out of that area, could you basically take a portion of that income tax that goes to the state normally and put it back into that area for infrastructure improvements? It's a concept, again, not fully vetted, but it did rise to the top. Another option on here that was discussed by the ODOT rail funding work group was the rail tax credit, which goes to property taxes that would be placed on railroad right-of-way going back to railroad infrastructure instead of back to the cities or counties that bring in that property tax. Another not easy conversation to have because of the lack of property tax income coming in. So, again, this is a framing for a discussion. It is not a legislative package. It is not a legislative concept. It was just an opportunity to bring people around the table and talk about what is a large need and figure out what the next steps are. So with that, Senator Beyer, thank you for being a co-convener and very much appreciate your time and effort.
No aha moments.
The aha moment to me was that we don't have a pipeline, and if we want to go and do different types of transportation infrastructure financing in the future, it will be hard to bundle projects to put it out on the market. And we also have that issue around sewer and water in the state because it's not a centralized state function. It's a city, county, district function. So there's no way right now to have that opportunity to say, how do we bundle projects to put them out on the market?
Michael, I can't recall the public transportation number. Does that include an adjustment for the lost revenues that go to transit?
An adjustment for
that.
Lost revenues.
Used
now, that's
to
why we
transit,
asked Victor
to
be
say.
Here. Victor, would you please come up?
Victor was really hoping to stay in the audience.
he knows better.
I know.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Victor Dodier with the Department of Transportation. When we did the needs assessment, we simply updated for inflation the work that had been done for the Oregon Transportation Plan in 2005. Pardon me, and we noted we tried not to attempt to do a reevaluation of the needs. There just simply wasn't time. And so the only things I did were to note that the lost revenue from the business income tax credit, the Betsy, lost revenues due to the adverse economic conditions, et cetera. We didn't try to come up with a new need number for public transportation.
So that $364 million does not include the loss of the Betsy tax credits.
No, it does not.
Which were fairly significant.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And we don't have an answer.
Okay. So the last thing I'll say is there's a lot of interest in financing mechanisms in this, that they rose to the top because people want to find different ways to be able to finance their projects. I think there's continued interest in that. I think there's continued interest in finding, thank you, Victor. You could stay if you wanted. and continuing some of the programs that already exist and making them more sustainable. And there's, I think, continued interest in dealing with this transit operation maintenance capital issue that still needs to be kind of seated and start to grow to figure out what to do because there is a interest but a lack of clarity on where to go next. So
I think the one thing that you didn't mention but I think is really important is there's really two different needs. One is the need for capital for improvements and the other one is operation and maintenance.
Yes.
And they're really not segmented out and the hole is getting even deeper for operation and maintenance,
right,
particularly on the transit side. Okay, other questions?
I think this would really help with that industrial land supply if we could knit the two together.
Sure.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate the update. All righty. Mr. Witte.
Because we're rolling real fast through this stuff. You should tell him he needs to take an hour and 15 minutes if we're going to get to 5 o'clock.
We don't need to get to 5 o'clock.
You don't have to tell him that. No, I'm just kidding.
We know that Mr. Whitty is so enthralled with his project that he'll go into great depth.
What?
Now you've done it.
Got it. Well, not quite. I can't solve that problem.
This is a recurring
theme. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is James Whitty. I'm a manager of ODOT's Office of Innovative Partnerships and Alternative Funding. Topic I'm about to speak to you about, I spent a lot of time in 2011 session in the House. So there's a lot of learning that happened there, and I'm going to try to catch you up as best I can and be happy to take questions, of course, if you have them. What we're talking about is a distance charge on light vehicles. When considering that, it's important to note that this is a user pays philosophy or strategy adopted by the legislature long ago. Far back as 1919, when the legislature passed the first gas tax, and then reaffirmed in 1925 with the 10-mile tax for heavy vehicles, and then really locked in stone with the first cost responsibility study in 1935. So that's over 77 years ago on this. Now, the nature of our that didn't work. Excuse me. You may have to go to slide 2 on your copies because I can't get this thing to shift.
Don't make some fortunes.
I only know Macintosh. Okay.
Oh, there we go.
The nature of our vehicles are changing right now. This really started around 1999 with the advent of the hybrid electric came into the economy, but we're starting to see that now happen again with the electric vehicles and plug-in hybrids and others that are coming. And this is changing our road finance too, right before our eyes. The operator of a 2012 8-cylinder Ford F-150 traveling 10,000 miles annually pays $214 in gas tax. The plug-in Prius, which just entered the market, I think in April, pays $32. And the Nissan Leaf, the operator pays nothing in state gas taxes. Last year, in July, the administration had agreement with the automakers to have a new corporate average fuel economy standard for light vehicles. And the average will be 54.5 miles per gallon beginning in 2025. And to achieve that, the automakers are going to have to make a lot of progress between now and then. What this means is, of course, fuel economy goes up, gasoline consumes goes down, which is good for various other policy reasons like reduction of greenhouse gas or reduced reliance on foreign oil, but revenues for our system goes down. These figures are based on 1 million miles traveled in the state of Oregon. The Road User Fee Task Force, which was established by the Oregon Legislature in 2001, and then appointed by the governor, Senate President, and Speaker of the House, was charged with developing a new system to replace the fuel tax as our main revenue source. And they came up with a distance-based charge, vehicle miles travel tax, or fee. And then ODOT, also in that bill, was required to run a pilot program for it. In 2011, the legislature reaffirmed the Road User Fee Task Force process with passage of 2138, which made additional changes to the statute. As a result of the task force's work, ODOT developed what was known as the pay-at-the-pump model for collecting the charge, and they tested it in 2006 and 2007. It involved installation of GPS receivers in 300 cars, and the owners paid 1.2 cents per mile for 1 year. There was a lot of regard for this project nationally because it really broke the topic broached the topic across the country, and there was a lot of support and critique. We had two national or congressionally developed commissions support it, the Policy and Revenue Study Commission and the Infrastructure Financing Commission.
as well as AASHTO and the Miller Commission, which had several former secretaries of transportation on it. But while they supported it, they noted some other issues. For example, how do you scale this thing up for 300 million motorists nationwide? What is the cost of having pump recognition equipment for these cars in every pump in the nation? And the technology, they worried would be stuck in time because we had one box in the car. The public also had other issues. For example, privacy. We were very concerned about privacy and made sure that we didn't transmit anything out of that GPS receiver in the car, but the public had concerns about it. Because, of course, a box is a box, and who knows what it does. And so that's understandable that they would have that concern. And then compliance, would it be expensive and difficult to comply, and fears of a large government bureaucracy. So ODOT listened to their complaints and then came up with a new potential program to deal with those complaints and spoke with the Road User Fee Task Force about changes, and they made changes. This is the new vision for the mileage tax collection program based on what I would call political and economic realities. First of all, no technology mandate, no government box, or any kind of push towards a government box, or any other technology for that matter. And that we integrate with the existing technology market. People are using smartphones and pads and computers and navigation units and in-vehicle telematics right now. In their vehicles, they should be able to use those types of technologies if they want to in the system. They should be able to have choices about whether they want to use one thing or another and not be pushed to one particular way of dealing with the system. And then the system needs to be open so that technologies can evolve with time. And then as new choice, new preferences come forward, they should be able to use them. So essentially what we're doing is we're making it simpler for them. They'll be able to use technologies they already use for another purpose and not something that we want to push on them. The final one is private sector administration. It's right now we have firms out there that are collecting data and collect doing account management. Why not use those companies now? They do a good job. So the idea is to have private sector take on those roles. What the choices we're talking about using now is allowing people to report their mileage directly from the odometer. That exists right now with insurance companies. It's pay-as-you-drive insurance. They do that now. Why not use that approach here? If they want to have their mileage differentiated by location because they're driving out of state or something like that, and they don't want to pay on those miles, they should be able to use a GPS device they may already own. And if they want to be out of the system altogether, they might purchase a flat annual tax of unlimited miles. And then another idea which the Road User Fee Task Force has to consider yet is buying miles in advance, a prepay, which wouldn't involve technology at all either. Okay. There were a number of questions that came up in the 2011 session about the legislation that was before the House. How burdensome will be the new system on motorists? What will be the electronic means of reporting and the cost for it? And how costly will it be to administer the program? And how many motorists will actually buy electric vehicles and plug-in hybrids anyway? The research, we've undertaken some research to answer those questions and a pilot program to answer those questions. The fleet forecast, which will be finished in June, we have numerous scenarios for what the marketplace might do, because who can really predict what the people will buy? They might buy electrics. They might buy plug-in hybrid electrics. They might buy more hybrids. They may buy more fuel-efficient internal combustion engines. So we have numerous scenarios for that, and I can tell you that the early returns on that work are that the revenues all spike downward under every scenario because we're moving to fuel-efficient vehicles. The work we have underway will also predict system costs as well as costs for the motorists to comply with the system, and then also give us a knowledge about the relative impact on urban and rural drivers. But the big question that we had from the Road User Fee Task Force in the House in 2011, where will the marketplace want to come forward and help ODOT do this? Will they want to actually participate? And so this last February, we issued a request for information, an RFI, to the marketplace and reserved 19 spots for them to come in and talk to us following a workshop. And we had all 19 slots filled. And then at the end, 28 firms submitted RFI responses. So they ranged from South Africa to South Korea, from New Zealand to Austria, and, of course, the United States and Canada. So we had a lot of interest in participating in this new system. Now we have an RFP underway for a new pilot. 18 of those firms I just mentioned joined together in 10 proposals for us, and we've just finished selecting who would be involved. I'm unable to talk about who at this moment because we're still negotiating contracts with them. But I can tell you what the pilot will look like. It will offer motorist technology choices for participating. We're not going to offer the non-technology options now because they are either too simple or we haven't had approval from the RFTUF yet, the Road User Fee Task Force yet, but we're going to do the technology piece in the fall. And we'll have multiple vendors, so motorists will be able to choose what they want to use. So there'll be 50. The project will start in September for 3 months. We're targeting 50 volunteers to actually pay a mileage charge of 1.56 cents per mile. That's based on 19 miles per gallon on average for a gasoline taxpayer. And then they also get a gas tax refund or offset. We're targeting VIPs. We want stakeholders involved. We want members of the Road User Fee Task Force, and they have actually said they will be involved, and the Oregon Transportation Commissioners. And further, I'm hoping that we can talk some state legislators to join us in the pilot. I asked the House and did get the chairman to say he was likely to join in the House Transportation Committee, and we're hoping to get senators as well. We can test any vehicle type, although the target during the 2011 session was electric vehicles and plug-in hybrids. For the pilot, we can test with any vehicle, but they have to be 2004 year or later.
Big Suburbans.
The volunteers will have to sign a contract in order to get to pay the mileage charge in lieu of the gas tax. We can't refund gas tax without that contract. And then they'll receive instruction in August. Now, how hard will this be? How hard will this be for you? Let me show you how hard it'll be. We have three options, technology options, for participants to choose from. The first one we call the basic unit. It has no GPS technology whatsoever, and it is very close, at least the unit we have, is very close to what's used by Progressive Insurance Company for pay-as-you-drive insurance. You've probably seen some of those commercials on television. It's very simple to install. You simply plug it into the diagnostic port in the car, and then you drive. And it will report all miles off your odometer. It's that simple. And then you'll get a bill in the mail or online, however you like, and you'll pay the bill.
So will the individual participant plug it in? Or is that will be done for them by somebody?
We can probably do it either way, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. What's to keep them from plugging it in and then taking it out?
Yes, that's a good question. That's a good question, Mr. Chair. If somebody signs up, they will have to actually start. We'll have to be receiving reports of mileage. If they pull it out, they will stop receiving reports. We'll have to inquire why they stopped. Was the car wrecked? Is it in the shop, or is it simply tossed in the glove box?
Thinking more of that. I mean, possible someone could have one and take off on vacation and be gone for 2-3 weeks and come back. It's also possible that they could be driving around and just decide to take it off for a couple of weeks and then put it back.
Yes, Mr. Chair, this is the point of inquiry. You're right. But it's a point where you inquire.
Where there's a deviation?
Yeah. The second option involves for people that want to use the same unit but drive out of state for, say, a trip to the Grand Tetons or, say, Grand Canyon, and they got a lot of miles out there. They don't want to pay in those miles. They can get an app for their Android phone, and then which connects through wireless Bluetooth connections with that device, and then that's all they have to do, and it will now report those miles as driven out of state. For those that want something else, there are two GPS-type units we have in the pilot. One is for off-road miles. It will, what's known as geofence those miles, so people that drive, say, for agriculture or forestry or ranching or something like that, they'll be able to use this device. It plugs in the same way. Another alternative will be a unit that performs internet cloud-based functions similar to a smartphone or other vehicle devices like OnStar. And that'll be an opportunity as well. There'll also be two tax processors involved, so the motors can choose one or the other. One will take the role of ODOT for a basic payment services, and another one will take the role, well, it will be a private sector firm providing more sophisticated payment services. So you'll choose your technology and you'll choose your tax processor. So as we've been discussing this for quite a few years, but I want you to know we're not alone. We did our pilot in 06 and 07. We were the first. And then the University of Iowa did field tests with a congressional appropriation in 2010. Then we have Minnesota that started their pilot last fall and is still underway. We have quite a few other states that have also done formal research in public in this area. And then I can tell you that we're excited about having Washington and Nevada join us in our pilot program. You'll manage your own volunteers, but use our payment system. So that will start in the fall. So we're hopeful that we can get legislative volunteers as well, because I think that would help understanding of the system and remove a kind of doubt about whether we can make it simple or not. I think the system is going to be quite simple and easy to use. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions of Mr. Witte? Senator Edwards, you look like you're contemplating a question.
No. Not at this point.
Not yet. Okay. Anybody else?
Thank you, Jim.
All right. So the last presentation is the standard project update. Paul?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. I'm going to give you a quick tour around the state with some of our major projects that we've been working on. A little different approach than I have in front of this committee, where I've given you more a broader from a program level. Going to dive a little bit into some specifics on different projects around the state. Not go too deep, just to keep us moving, and because I'm not the expert on every one of these projects, but try to talk to you about these projects in a way that highlights some of the policy issues that we may be talking about here that you may be considering in the future. So just starting in the Portland area, these first three projects actually tie in with our previous agenda item talking about the regional industrial land study. These first three projects relate closely to some of the Tier 1 properties that were talked about in that presentation. The first one is the Sunrise Corridor. This is the extension of the Milwaukee Expressway past 205 on out towards Rock Creek. We have an environmental document that covers that entire corridor, four-lane facility, with a couple of interchanges. This project actually falls short of that within the amount of money that we have. It not only scales a project back in length, but also narrows it from a four-lane to a two-lane project. The project has $100 million of JTA funds on the project, $20 million of OTIA-3 funds, and $10 million of other federal funds, along with about $20 million in right-of-way from Clackamas County for this project. We hope this project to begin next summer, and with probably about a two-year construction season on this project. This project's critical just for those economic growth in this area. It's home to some of our larger employers, distribution centers, Oregon Ironworks, Fred Meyer, Safeway, Redaway Trucking, a very important economic hub for the region as well as for the state. And this project will alleviate many of the transportation concerns in this corridor. Next project, turning to the Troutdale Interchange. This is the one that was talked about with the FedEx development and the former Reynolds Aluminum property. This project is also a JTA project, about $24 million that we have of JTA funds, $4 million of federal funds, and a local commitment of $1 million. This project improves the on and off ramps as well as the connections underneath the freeway. And provides a much better situation we have today that we have a one-way traffic going underneath the freeway. This provides for two-way and also raises the height of the bridges in the area. The importance of this project is really, again, to support that Troutdale Reynolds Industrial Park, which FedEx is a part of, and there's other opportunities in that land that the port owns for further job growth in that area. So another key project. Also note this was a project that was talked about in redistribution of JTA funds last time where we were savings from some of the other JTA projects in the area were pointed towards this project if those were to develop. Another project that we talked about was the Brookwood Havisha Road or Chute Road project out on the Sunset Highway out on Highway 26, another one critical to job growth in that area. Again, talked about in the industrial lands conversation with some tier one property in this area. This is also a project that we hope to begin next summer, about $45 million of JTA funds. This project adds a loop ramp, widens the structure, and generally improves capacity on this interchange for that growth and that industrial land in that area. So there's some of the economic drivers and employers in that area. Moving on to Newburgh-Dundee, another very large project that we have some money to construction, a portion of the project. We have just about a signed environmental document, hopefully a few weeks away from having that signed environmental document. That document is a much larger corridor. It's depicted here on this map running on the right of that picture on 99W around Newburgh, around Dundee, and then connecting back into to 99W. The amount of money that we have is $192 million of JTA funds, $20 million, $22 million of federal funds, $20 million of local funds that are contributing to this, and $14 million of our regular STIP modernization funds. The red line in here, if you can pick that out, is really the piece that we plan to start construction in 2014. Again, this is a scaled-back version, both in length and in width. So instead of a four-lane with interchanges, we're building a scaled-back two-lane version with traffic lights through this section. And again, we hope to start that in 2014. This is really to address public safety concerns and congestion in this corridor. If you've ever been in this corridor on a Friday afternoon or Sunday evening, it's a very, very congested corridor. And this has been long waited in that community too for that relief. Woodburn Interchange is another JTA project. We have $43 million of JTA funds on this project. Again, we hope to start construction in 2013. With this project, so that's next summer. We have a local commitment of about $8 million, $14 million of our STIP money in that, and we're short about $10 million on this project. Again, this, like Newburgh-Dundee and Sunrise Corridor, we are hoping for federal earmarks with those projects when we first put this package together as part of the JTA package, but those federal earmarks have not materialized, and this is one that is where we haven't been able to scale back to meet those reduced expectations or reduced funding. Here's a photograph of just the kind of the engineering components of the project, but it'll be a standard loop ramps in two of the quadrants that will greatly improve the capacity of the interchange, as well as some improvements along 219 with access control and just in improving the gateway to this area and those streets. But one of the features I wanted to highlight was the transit facility that will be part of this. We've been able to come up with some transit funding to go with this and really provide a place for a transition from local transit to regional transit for park and ride and really a multiple use type of facility for transit as that grows in the corridor.
So, Anna, can you go back a slide? Two slides. That one. The
looks like a clover leaf. How much are you going to have to take out? It looks like you're taking out some commercial facilities. I don't recall there being that much room there.
Mr. Chairman, yes, in both those quadrants we'll be acquiring a significant amount of right-of-way. And the bottom portion there towards the Walmart, if you're familiar with the area, there is some, but it doesn't get into that Walmart development, doesn't go quite that far. And then to the other quadrant toward the outlet mall, there's some development, again, in that area, but not into those kind of main areas of development in either one of those areas. But there will be a significant amount of right-of-way impacts, not only in those two loop ramps, but throughout the corridor.
Take out the breakfast place.
That's the breakfast place.
And they add to Cloverleaf ramp. Just kidding.
Yeah.
But there is a breakfast place there.
Does that on the, I guess it's the west side, does that solve all that backup that happens during the high peak times?
This will solve those backups. What it doesn't solve is the extreme traffic we have at Thanksgiving weekend or an extreme shopping holiday for the outlet mall. That volume of traffic, this won't accommodate, but it will accommodate.
Still
going to
have them parking in the center lane of I-5?
The everyday experience that we have in a typical evening rush hour, yes, it does solve those problems. Pioneer Mountain Eddyville. This is a project we've been working on since 2005. It's in the heart of the Coast Range on Highway 20. It's really the last segment of Highway 20 between Corvallis and Newport to be really modernized. We've had a number of projects in that corridor to improve that, and this is the last one, and really saved the hardest of the project till of that corridor till the end. This is a map showing the work that we have underway. The red line is depicting the existing alignment. It's about 10 miles on the existing alignment. The blue alignment is the new alignment, or about 6 miles. So not only are we straightening out the alignment, we're also making it considerably shorter in its route from Corvallis to Newport. While I'm on the slide, the portions in the foreground there where the red and the blue line are nearly concurrent, that portion of the project is complete, and the traffic is on the new alignment, which is the blue alignment. It's really where the blue and red line diverge is where we're having the current problem with the landslides and the bridges in the corridor. This project was started in 2005. It was a design-build contract. A design-build contract is where we enter into a contract with one firm that does both the design and the construction. It's not our typical method of construction. We've done about 20 different design-builds projects in the last 10 years, and this project was one of those. In a design-build relationship, it's important to remember that the contractor is the engineer of record and the person responsible for making design decisions that we normally would make in our normal construction method, where we are the engineer of record and responsible for the contract. As this contract moved forward, the contractor ran into major landslides in the area where the blue and the red lines diverge there in the photograph. As we got into those, we settled did a change order with the contract to recognize that change of site condition, and $43 million was the price tag for that change order for the contractor in 2008. They proceeded with their mitigation or repairs of those landslides and began building bridges on top of those repairs. As they began to set the beams on top of those bridges in 2010, they noticed that their mitigation had failed. We've been in contact with them since, talking about where we go from here with the project. A number of different options that we talked about, including going to a dispute resolution board, which we were at last fall with them. And finally, earlier this month, on May 2nd, we signed an agreement with them to terminate their contract. That settlement entailed them forgiving $16.5 million worth of claims they have in the project, as well as $15 million for the project. Going forward on the project, we have a contract out to bid right now, ready to go to contract in July. That work will be underway this summer. We'll be followed up by an additional contract the following summer to complete the project.
Is that a design build?
That is not a design-build. Both those contracts will be our standard low-bid contracts, where we will be the engineer of record and control of the contract. We will manage those out of our local Corvallis office, and it will be very similar to our normal contracting method.
Can I ask a question? Go ahead. Were those in-state contractors that won that design-build?
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, it was Granite Construction out of California was the prime contractor.
Paul, one of the questions that I know that people have, I know Senator Sardad, is should we have known that sooner? Should we have pulled the plug sooner on that? Any response?
Yeah, I think, Mr. Chairman, as we think back on where we were in 2008 in that contract, we had those questions and had those discussions, given where we were in the contract, and again thinking we had one of the nation's best contractors there working on the contract. We thought we recognized the slide issues. They were in a good position with their team of experts to proceed with the design and construction of the project. We thought in the best interest of keeping the project moving. Again, I think one of the complicating factors with this project is the very short construction windows that we have in the heart of the Coast Range. You literally have 3 or 4 months a year we can do work. And any stoppage of work that we have with the project can cause years of delay. And keeping the momentum of the project was important. We considered those things, but decided to proceed with the contract arrangement that we had in place.
Did they do adequate geotech?
That'll be a question to explore further. I guess there are still legal matters around some of those questions. I'd rather not comment too deeply on that at this point. Just given that we're still in. Yeah. Freshly out of settlement, and there's still other issues to be settled with that, so I'd rather not address that. But to just talking about going forward, again, we're going to have two contracts going forward. We have the settlement payment of $15 million. We have almost $30 million left on the existing contract, combined with savings from our TIA 3 bridge project or program. We think we'll fund the rest of the project. So while we anticipate completion by 2015, the additional funding will come from those other funding sources I talked about.
Will the finished product look similar to the route that was being worked on?
Mr. Chairman, yes. The route will be similar to what you see on blue line here. What will be different is the height of the alignment. We're not going to have the alignment on bridges. It'll be on culverts to minimize the risks. Failure of the landslides, if you have a few inches movement of the landslide up a 100-foot high bridge, you can have major problems in your bridge. Whereas if you're on culverts and pavement, you might have a slight crack in your pavement that you're able to patch. So we're picking a less risky design moving forward, given what we've experienced so far with the project. So one of the primary purposes of this one is safety. We have a number of accidents in this corridor, given its curves and narrow shoulders. Another project to talk about is the Beltline project, I-5 and Beltline units 3 and 4. Here's a picture showing all units 1, 2, 3, and 4. So we've completed unit 1, which was the flyover project, and unit 2, which added additional improvements on the Springfield side of the interchange. Units 3 and 4, you show there, are in the northwest quadrant is unit 3, and then unit 4 is in the southwest quadrant of this interchange. One of the reasons I wanted to highlight this project is not only is it going to go to bid later this year, Unit 3 is, and Unit 4 will follow that, but also wanted to talk about another aspect of the Jobs and Transportation Act was talking about practical design. And here's a side-by-side comparison of kind of where we started with the project and where we currently are now. So this shows that northwest quadrant of that interchange, which is the Unit 3. And on the left side is really if we pull out our design manual and would design that with our typical standards and a typical design speed, is what that generates. And what generates on the right is something where we went back and looked at those design speeds and said, rather than our typical design speeds, what if we went with a 60-mile-an-hour design speed, a lesser design speed in there, and we're able to really push back the right-of-way footprint. We're able to, if you can see in the earlier, but if in the lower left the bottom there, you see in the original design, there's three structures there, and you look in the new design, there's only two, and there's a very large structure kind of over on the right of the new design that goes away completely because of the lower design speeds. Because of this, we're able to save nearly $30 million with this design, and again, this is a project we were expecting a federal earmark on, that we think we can do this, both these phases, without that federal earmark and still fund this project completely. Mm-hmm. In fact, as we total up all our kind of puts and adds on our costs of our JTA projects, we think we might have enough savings on this project to fully fund the Woodburn project that I talked about earlier. But we'll be back to you next session to talk to you about that. That's about that more. Mm-hmm. Staying in Eugene, Springfield area, the Willamette River Bridge project is another key project for that community, a $200 million project. Here's a photograph of it that was actually taken last fall. If those of you in the area know that that temporary bridge there on the left of that photograph is gone, and the new bridge right in the center of that picture is starting to come up out of the river. The new bridge is there on the right, and the twin of that bridge is what we have under construction now. It's a very beautiful bridge, and I think it's one that the community we've worked with hard to gain support for, and I think they appreciate very much. This is another project that we have a different contracting method with. It's a method called CMGC. It's a method where in a design build method, we go back and kind of stand back from the project, and the contractor has the engineering record and the construction. In this phase, we have a relationship with the design firm and then an independent relationship with the construction firm, and we stay in the middle of those conversations as we go through the different variables on the project and really stay in control of both the construction and the design with the two different firms rather than kind of at arm's length through the design build process that I described. And this has been very successful to accomplish not only the project but many of our DBE goals and many of the other aspects that we have in the community we're able to influence in a way that has some very positive outcomes for the community. Here's some of the partnerships that we've had in moving through, and again, I mentioned the CMGC with this project. I select this slide in here just to depict the projects that I've talked about so far in the kind of the peak of this funding diagram.
Excuse me, Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since you're moving on in the presentation, I wanted to ask, going back to the Willamette River Bridge project, why would CMGC be used here rather than just your traditional process?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Edwards, one of the reasons was speed of getting the project underway. We were very anxious to keep this project and this program moving, so it offers us speed as well as ability to manage the risks of the projects in a way of bringing the construction firm on early while we have the design firm there to really understand what the design may mean in construction terms and really, again, work those issues in design, which may we see later in construction simultaneously, to kind of gain the benefits of a design build, but in a way that we're involved up kind of up close and personal in the project.
So mm-hmm. Speed was a
speed. So speed
you,
as
you
well.
You thought it was just innovation. Doing something in Eugene.
So far the projects I've been talking about are really in the kind of the mountain of this graph or in the top part of this graph. One of the projects I want to talk about next is in the kind of the lower part of this or the STIP, kind of our normal bread and butter type of projects that we do, but it's still a very large and very significant project. This is a project on the coast in the Coos Bay area, the McCullough Bridge project where we're doing cathodic protection. It's a total of about a $70 million project. We have funding for the south half, which we've completed the $30 million and still have not secured all the funds for the north half of the bridge. This is an important bridge for the community, but an important bridge for the state. If this bridge were to fail, it would be hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe approach even $1 billion to replace this structure. So it's a very big asset that's a very important for us to continue to maintain and pay attention to. Here's a picture of the work we're doing, that cathodic protection that goes through and deals with the rust and the corrosion within the rebar of the concrete. The contractor moves that containment area along the bridge. You can see on the right of that picture is work they've done as they move towards the steel structure there in the center. You can see work they have yet to do in that picture. Here's what the finished product looks like from underneath. It really preserves a historic asset for the community as well as just the McCullough bridges that we see up and down the coast. Another project I wanted to touch on is in Southern Oregon. This is the Fern Valley exit, or the Phoenix exit, just south of Medford. It's a $72 million project funded by OTO3 and JTA funds. This is designed, one of the reasons I'll put this up, it's in contrast to what we just talked about in Woodburn and worried about maybe our favorite breakfast place. This is a design that really puts a very small footprint on a very high-capacity interchange in a very unique way. This will be the first interchange of its type on the West Coast. I have a picture here of one they've just opened up in Missouri. But it's a very, very different design where you have basically you switch traffic during the middle of the interchange, and then you switch it back on the following side of the interchange. And what that does for you is makes all your turns right turns. So if you think about the easiest thing for you to do as a driver, it's to make a right turn. And so now coming up to the interchange, you obviously can make your right turn, but as you cross through the interchange, as you move to the other side, your left turn, since you're on the other side of the road, now becomes a free right turn. And then you cross back over again. So you have two very simple signals on either end of the interchange.
Like the sliced bread of interchanges.
Yeah. So this will be interesting to watch. As we build this thing starting next summer in construction year of 2013, this will be a new interchange for us. But what it offers us is not only from a cost standpoint and a right-of-way standpoint, a very innovative way to look at saving not only right-of-way dollars but land use in the area. One last project. This is from Central Oregon. This is a JTA project just at the south end of the Bend bypass, if you're familiar with that. This is it has $25 million of JTA funds. It takes the traffic signal, if you're familiar there in the south end of where the old 97 comes into the new bypass, takes that traffic signal out and replaces it with an overcrossing as well as some improvements.
Where's this one at?
So if you're familiar with where the outlet mall is or where 97 at the south end of Bend, old 97 comes in, it's that traffic light right there at the south end is kind of at the center of that picture. This provides an overcrossing, an interchange for that old 97 coming into the new Bend bypass and takes that traffic signal out and does some other improvements. Obviously, the freight mobility within 97 is a very important lifeline route for the state of Oregon. So, quick tour around the state, some of the major projects.
Did I see that right? Are you putting in traffic circles, or do those already exist?
Those are new roundabouts. They'll be on the City of Bend system. They won't be on the state highway system, but City of Bend has a number of traffic roundabouts now, and this will just be adding to the city.
I thought we had
streets.
A conversation during the last session about not doing roundabouts.
Yes.
Until something was resolved.
All right. These are not on the state highway
system.
Not
on the state.
On the city. On the city system.
Hey, Mr. Correct. Russell.
Yeah.
I don't want to go to catch up to Kennewick.
Yeah.
Any questions of Paul? Yes, not. Great job, Paul. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It really demonstrates how much ODOT's got going and doing very well.
Most appreciated.
I think that takes us to the end of our agenda, right?
We're all out of stuff, Mr. Chair.
Yay.
A lot of stuff. Any additional comments? If none, we are adjourned.